Welcome back to Looks Like New, the radio podcast of the Media Economics Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm Julia Martins, and this is the show where we ask old questions about new technology, exploring how the tools shaping our world connect the timeless concerns about power, justice, and human flourishing. Today, we are having a conversation that feels both urgent and deeply rooted in questions we've been wrestling with for generations. Who gets to participate in society? What happens when entire communities are left behind? And how do we build systems that serve everyone, not just the privileged few? Our guest is Dr. Nicole Turner-Lee, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and one of the nation's leading voices on digital equity and technology justice. Nicole directs the Center for Technology Innovation and recently founded the AI Equity Lab. She has spent her career illuminating the human stories behind our digital divides. Her new book, Digitally Invisible, How the Internet is Creating the New Underclass, takes us beyond the statistic and policy papers to meet the real people navigating life in America's digital deserts. From students in urban neighborhoods without reliable internet to seniors in rural communities struggling to access healthcare online, what makes Nicole's work so compelling is how she weaves together the personal and the political, showing us that digital equity isn't just about infrastructure or broadband speeds. It's about fundamental questions of who belongs and who gets heard in our increasingly connected world. She's asking us to consider whether we are building a digital society that lifts everyone up or one that deepens the very inequalities technology promised to solve. Nicole, welcome to Looks Like New. It's wonderful to have you with us. Let's start with your journey and into this work. What first drew you to focus on the intersection of technology and just social justice? Was there a particular moment or experience that made you think, this is where I need to focus my energy?
Well, thank you so much, Julie, for having me on the podcast. And to all the listeners, listen to Looks Like New if you have not already been a loyal subscriber. So it's so interesting that you start with this question of what started me on my journey. And I would like to share with people that getting into technology policy was not a linear experience. Essentially, I was in Chicago pursuing my PhD in sociology, and I started to see, you know, just the effects and ramifications of systemic poverty or discrimination on certain communities there. It's no secret that Chicago is probably one of the most segregated cities in the country. But more importantly, you know, people were basically surviving in certain those communities versus thriving. So I really started in this space as a volunteer in the Community Technology Center movement in the 90s. This wasn't necessarily something that I walked into intentionally, but I knew based on my experiences of using technology in undergraduate and graduate school that there was a there to this new medium that was essentially transforming the world. Now, Julie, let me just tell you, this was before the smartphone and before artificial intelligence became popular. This is what we were talking about. And some people will follow me, 386 computers and basically a BlackBerry. You know, in my volunteer experience, I found that there were communities in low-income housing that barely had enough technology to prepare for the transition of jobs from the newspaper to online. And that's basically where I felt like if we're going to engage people in our digital economy that was beginning to ferment, that we needed to do things that not only address their ability to get online, but their ability to address some of the systemic inequalities that sort of frame their life, like poverty or chronic illness or lack of access to healthcare or educational disparities. That's basically how I started. I started as a sociologist, right, with a lot of inquisitiveness about where this technology was going to take us back in the early 90s.
And how much has it changed, John?
You know, it's interesting. I think the systemic inequality still exists. You know, many of the people that we're still trying to connect are still very much reminders of the type of people that I encountered early on in my career. I think the difference is the technology is much more advanced. I mean, the conversations we're having on artificial intelligence, and hopefully we'll talk about today, they're really transforming not just like how people consume technology, but the decisions that are made around their eligibility for social programs, for example, or jobs or credit. And so I would have never anticipated this. Outside of, let me just be clear, on Saturday mornings, I used to run home and watch cartoons because back then you played outside until the streetlights came on and then you watch cartoons. And one of them was The Jetsons, which you could still catch today on cable television or on the internet. And for me, I would have never imagined that we'd see the autonomous vehicles that George Jetson used to drive around with, or we see the type of AI systems that they predicted back when that cartoon was just a very cruddy black, you know, color version, because we don't have some of the advanced and sophisticated models that we have today when it comes to pixelation and animation. So somewhat, yes. I mean, George Jetson predicted it, right? And his wife. But to another degree, no. I'm really surprised at how far we've come in my 30 years of doing this work.
And your book, Digitally Invisible, is filled with such powerful personal stories. How did you go about finding these voices? And what was it like spending time with people living in these digital deserts?
So it was interesting. As a sociologist, I wanted to write a book, much like Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted, you know, thus the tagline of the book in terms of how the internet has created the new underclass. It was important to me because we see a lot of technology books, and they're often written from the standpoint of sort of elevating innovation. And it was important for me to write a book that would be respected in the circles in which I run, which are our academic disciplinary circles, but also a trade book that could be adopted by many people who could find themselves somewhere in the book. So part of the story creation was initiated by my 81-year-old aunt, who was like, I'm not going to read a policy book. If you give me something that is too dense, I'm not going to read it. So I wanted to seek out people like her who were still carrying around flip phones and, you know, living in parts where they could afford broadband access at her age. And I reached out to my network of more than 25, 30 years, just asking where I should go. And it became really interesting because there were so many places I could have gone and still places I want to go. I mean, I still meet very amazing people that are finding ways to solve some of their digital challenges. But in particular, I wanted to be very intentional. I knew I wanted to look at how technology intersected with education, how it intersected with healthcare, with housing, with rural communities, urban communities, all the typical areas that people explore. But the difference was I didn't want to talk about it as a Washington, D.C. insider. I wanted to talk about it as a person who went to the neighborhoods and really lived the indigenous experiences of the people that I met. So it took me to some of the farming communities. I'm a city girl from New York, and I went to areas where there were more cows and people. In fact, that's the title of one of the chapters. So it took me to Amish communities where I got to meet, you know, people in predominantly all white communities that were farmers, second, third, fourth generation, who didn't have access to technology to be able to be productive with their land. It took me to Syracuse University, where I went to the first affordable housing complex in the New York State, where I was able to meet seniors who were battling identity theft and really trying to understand the way that the internet could be more protected so that they couldn't be, you know, sort of wrapped up in scams and scandals. It took me to areas in rural communities that were predominantly Black or Latina that, you know, for me was interesting because at the time I started the book, there was a lot of politicization of the rural communities to assume that they were very homogenous, when what I wanted to do in the book was really suggest that they were very heterogeneous, because there's a lot of people either moving back to rural or some people who actually want to stay. And so some of those people I found through familiar networks. I did what was called snowballing, where I started with them. They introduced me to five people. I met five more people. But I have to admit, what was so incredibly cool about doing the book, you'll find all these stories of people that I outline. And you also find out a little bit more about me. I think deep inside, you know, I'm a sociologist, I'm a policymaker at Brookings, which is like a global think tank. But deep inside, I think I want to be a change agent, right? There's this part of me that wants to be a person that is able to articulate the stories of people that are not often heard in predominant policymaking circles. So that was really important for me. And spending time with them in their domains was even more critical, because it gave me a sense of not just their technology use, but who they were as a person. So I'll give you a perfect example. I met a young man in a rural community, African-American guy, fourth generation rural resident, essentially had a cell phone, but it stayed off for most of the month. He was a day laborer. And as a result, he couldn't find work halfway through the month you know, he told me that the phone was like a box without any power. It was just a dead box for him. And, you know, you don't get those stories in any data set. You don't get those in any type of, you know, as researchers, you know, you don't find those qualitative statistics anywhere, are those stories. And it was important for me to bring life to those experiences so that everybody kind of knew this is what most of the world is dealing with. And it's not just pedantic on the part of policymakers to say people lack access to broadband. I mean, those numbers have faces behind them. And so that's what was really cool about spending time with people where they lived.
Any other stories stand out to you?
I mean, there were so many. I mean, I remember I wanted to go visit schools. I visited a Black Rose school in Alabama, about 2 hours outside of Birmingham, and just met this incredible principal who literally had a food pantry in her office in a reusable red bag. And I'm very illustrative in the book about these details because I wanted to keep the realness of these folks so that you could actually come along this journey with me. But she was quite interesting because essentially she had gotten a tablet for all of the 700 students in her school, a consolidated school, get this, of K through 12, not K through 8, K through 12, but they had a one-to-one solution based on what President Obama had did with the Connect Ed program. But I remember speaking with her when the pandemic hit, because I had started my research a couple of years before the pandemic. And I remember her writing me an email saying, you know, all that excitement and charisma I demonstrated, well, those tablets are books without paper because the pandemic has hit and there's nowhere for these kids to go. And that was similar to a school I visited in Arizona outside of Phoenix, which was all Latina. And I thought that the kids were just incredibly ahead because all of them had cell phones, only to find out from the principal and, you know, what a time like that 2 years ago and how relevant it is today. But they had those cell phones, not necessarily to do homework or to sign up for government services, but they had it as a lifeline in case a parent or guardian was deported. This is the only way that they can get in touch with these elementary school students. Wow. And so there was so many people like that, that, you know, showed up in the book that made me really reconsider like how I even talk about the digital divide, which is why, you know, Julie, I didn't call it the digital divide, you know, how the internet's creating a new underclass. I really consider these people to be digitally invisible. Like, we don't know them. We don't know their experiences. We know a little bit about where they live. We know a little bit about their consumption, but we really don't know how that affects their everyday lives. So this book was more than just about wires and bits and bytes. It was really, to your point, I'm glad you pick up on it, it was about the human stories that resonate for everyday people who may not necessarily understand just how important it is to be connected today. And it was that reason that I really focused in on who are the digitally invisible in the United States and essentially the world.
And that connects to my next question. I'm sure the writing process for a book like this must have been both illuminating and heartbreaking. And what surprised you most as you were researching and writing? Were there stories or realities that even you as an expert in the field weren't fully prepared for?
So interesting. A couple of things. So I would go in and talk to people I'd introduce myself as like, hey, I'm a researcher out of DC. I'm not the police. I'm not a social worker. I'm actually here because I'm writing a story about your internet access, right? And they were like, what are you? And I'm like, no, I'm coming because I want to know how you use the internet. And what so surprised me was like, I would meet all these people and they were like, no, I don't use the internet. Not me. And then you'd find out that they thought the internet was Facebook and that was it. Or they would say, right, they would think it was just social media. So I found that to be interesting. In fact, I'm doing some research on that now. Like, what really is the internet? And like, what do people really think about the internet? And then I would meet people who are like, I don't use the internet because I don't trust it. And then you stick with them for another 30, 40 minutes and you find out that they use things like, you know, electronic payment methods or, you know, they're using the internet, but different parts of the internet, but they still don't consider themselves to be on the internet. And so that was surprising to me, like the fact that we really don't have clear vernacular on what the internet is and that there are so many different definitions around that. The other thing that was very surprising to me is that my career really like mirrored the political will to solve this issue. And so I write in the book sort of what I started in the space under former President Clinton and Vice President Gore, who really are who I consider to be like the fathers of the internet. You know, Vint Cerf is the father of the internet when it came to the search query. But they really set the tone for policymakers to want to invest in affordable residential internet access. But then I follow this trend that whenever there was a Republican president, he would roll back that part of it and focus it on supply. So what was also interesting is that I have lived to be old enough to see how the internet has transformed itself via policy since President Clinton, which I would like to say is a long time, right? Because I was a mature woman at that time. So to think that, you know, I was able to watch four or five presidential administrations, how they deal with it and can kind of predict what they do with it, is very interesting. And that was really eye-opening for myself. I was like, oh my goodness, I've been in this a very long time. And then I think the other thing that really like was very like disturbing is the fact that there are people that will do whatever it takes to get online because they have no other choice. And so there was a woman I met in a parking lot. She was in a library, just sort of putting a fit up about why she needed a library card immediately. And the librarians were like, no, you have to come back with this documentation. We can't issue a replacement. And she's like, no, I need my library card. I need my library card. So I did what I did. And I was like, hi, I'm Nicole. I'm doing a story on the internet, a book on the internet. Do you have a minute? I'm just really curious why you were so incessant with the librarians that you needed a library card. And then that conversation, which was probably supposed to be like 10 minutes, turned into 2 hours because she had just found out that she had stage 4 breast cancer and she needed a library card because a doctor had just put up her files. And that has been something that has stuck with me, I think, for this book. You know, when you think about the challenges of healthcare, but more importantly, it stuck with me because this woman doesn't have the luxury to do that kind of searching from the comfort of her home. And when I was working in the space at a previous nonprofit, my old boss used to make this statement that people should have the right to do private transactions within the comfort of their home. And, you know, more than 20, 30 years later, we still have people like Francis. And so that's what's made me sort of think through as the book, you know, was published in August of last year. I'm about to go to audiobook and then paperback next year. But part of it is like, how do we make people digitally visible? And what does that project look like? And is it the storytelling that we need to do? Is it more people just grabbing these? I'm very happy that I've noticed that more people tell stories since my book came out. I have to admit, I take credit for that. I watch a lot of things online and I see people telling more of the stories like people that I met, but we have to do more of that so people can contextualize this beyond just the technology and really see how being connected factors into one's quality of life. But it was a hard book to write. I'm just going to tell you, I was working, COVID had hit. I tell you, it was not easy, but I got through it.
And it turned out great. And talking about the pandemic, you know, you've been working on digital equity issues for years, like you said, but the pandemic really brought these inequalities into sharp focus in ways that were impossible to ignore. So how did that moment change the conversation around digital access? And did it feel like a turning point or more like a temporary awakening?
So it's funny, I used to tell people, you know, after I, you know, shared that exchange with Kathy Trimble, the principal, and she told me, you know, the books were like no paper, having no paper, because the kids couldn't get to the school to get online. You know, it made me think about like how disturbing that was because I had just seen her about 2 weeks prior. And so here we were that now people like her were suffering, right? Because they were having what they thought were in the, you know, the beginnings of a process they've been working very hard to accomplish. And now the pandemic came and it kind of rolled that back. So I used to tell people, it's the thing I thought was always funny. I said, people, you know, when the pandemic hit, the digital divide almost made me feel like I had multiple dates to the prom. And honestly, I had none because I didn't go. And so I was like, compared to being a high school senior with no date to the prom, I had tons of people who wanted to talk about this. So this is like a dormant issue that suddenly became alive because now everybody had to be connected. You know, there were no nursing home visits. There were no safe ways to work in your workplace physically. There were challenges with getting kids online. And so what was exciting is that we were getting much more attention to this issue. What was worrisome is that, again, going back to President Clinton, we had all this time to make sure we could actually do this, but yet the partisanship kept pushing this to the back burner, depending who was on office. And so I found that to be quite interesting because, you know, we had the bandwidth. I mean, United States, outside of Japan, you know, became a front leader when it came to mobile technology. That mobile technology led to more ride sharing and the app economy. 5G wouldn't, you know, many of these apps wouldn't be available without LTE technology and 5G. Our ability to order groceries or catch a cab, you name it, we could do now from our cell phones. And then more importantly, where we see artificial intelligence, none of that would happen without the telecommunications infrastructure. So we had worked really hard to get to a state where it should have been seamless. But in reality, it was a disaster, right? We had over 50 million school-age kids that were sent home from 125,000 school districts, you know, ballpark figure there, and a good proportion of them couldn't get online for school because they lacked internet at home. Or college kids that tried to go home from their campuses and literally had to drive 2 or 3 miles to the closest Starbucks to be able to get online, or coffee shop, or whatever the case may be. We saw seniors that, you know, had never used their phone for telehealth or telemedicine, learning and navigating that because they weren't unable to go to the doctor. I mean, it became for me like a social crisis, and one which really reflected systemic barriers that I had already demonstrated with the book, you know, were playing out in society during the pandemic. And you would think that we learned something, right? And to your point, like, whereas we had this opportunity to kind of do things right, it became a temporary fix. Because what happened, as soon as we realized that we could safely return to our workplaces and our schools, you know, now look at where we're at. No cell phones in the classroom, no technology use, generative AI is bad. I mean, we're definitely like pushing back against all the technology that we realized we needed during the pandemic. And I tell people this, like, I know, like, there's a lot of research suggesting that we're oversaturated and over-addicted, but we also found students who were sort of adapting to the new future of work. They were doing PowerPoints in collaboration with other classmates. They had to learn how to work remotely when appropriate. I mean, those were skills that I think to this day are going to translate into the workplace. Far beyond, like, can you fill out online application? You know, now we're seeing a lot of companies requiring videos as pre-screeners. And now I think a lot more people know how to do that stuff, you know, and we could talk a little bit more about like generative AI. But my point is, what could have been a groundswell moment for us to just change our structure feels like we're sort of now, as the technology has become more advanced, kind of pushing back against it. And not necessarily the AI, because the AI is out there like crazy, right? We're pushing back against just general basic access to technology, assuming still and kind of returning to the assumption that people, everybody has it. And that's what my book showed, we don't.
And let's expand on that a little bit. You know, the title Digital Invisible is so evocative, and it suggests people who are there but somehow not seen. And you mentioned that before about the statistics. But what does that invisibility look like day to day? And how do people become invisible in our digital society? And what are the consequences of this invisibility?
I mean, I think it's a real, you know, fact that if you're not connected to the internet, that there will be things that you're unable to do or compete for, or even have some general basic knowledge on. And, you know, we're seeing that day to day. Like, if you notice, we commonly get directed to the internet to apply for jobs or to check our housing property sales or to see how well our kids are doing or to gather their report cards. You know, we have a surcharge in many respects for in-person engagement. You know, if you decide, if you listen to some of these bots lately, if you decide to engage with a person, you pay a surcharge. This call may be monitored and there may be a surcharge assessed. And so we definitely see a society in which just some of the natural conveniences have migrated online. And we also see a society where some of the more important activities that sort of define your quality of life are also migrating online. And for me, that's where the digital invisibility shows up. So we saw that in the pandemic. The only way you could register for a vaccine was to get online. The only way you could do certain things was to get online. And we see in this effort to sort of create efficiency and productivity by having people get to online spaces, we sort of underestimate how many people are not capable of doing that based on not having broadband at home or being like Francis, waiting in a long line at the library just to get a free kiosk and not recognizing that you've left your digital imprint on that public computer if you don't have the digital literacy. And so, you know, there's a lot of layers of invisibility. Some of it is structural. And I suggest in the book, farmers who are fourth generation farmers who are now competing against highly digitized farms that are much larger, that can be much more productive because they are using advanced manufacturing versus, you know, the person who inherited his farm from his father that is still essentially using, you know, shovel to make sure that they're doing the right tilling of their soil. One guy I met said he has basic internet, but not enough to his farm, which means that he has to go into town just to order supplies. He's digitally invisible because we assume that all people have access or are using it pretty much ubiquitously. And, you know, for me, it does elicit a conversation for the United States as to where do we want to be when it comes to digital access at the just very basic level. I, you know, I'll tell the story real quick. So I used to go to China a lot as part of my work at Brookings, and I used to peel off and we used to go to this real small water town for this big conference. Now, outside of people thinking I was Michelle Obama, which they often did, even though I'm shorter, I ran into a very small marketplace, and I'll never forget it. Again, very small town in China on water, beautiful. And I go to purchase a scarf, and the 88-year-old woman pulls out a QR code on her phone where I'm trying to give her cash. And that was just 4 or 5 years ago. And so I know, I mean, just imagine, not to say that, you know, China doesn't have its own issues, but it does suggest that the country has thought very well and hard about digital access at its very, you know, fundamental focus. And I think, again, we take for granted that everybody's connected. We take for granted, as I suggested with people and how they define the internet, that everybody knows what the internet is. And I think we need to go back and do some soul searching and get some really good data on the invisible people just to clearly understand how it is impacting their well-being. And that, Julie, is like where I want to land in my work more broadly. Like, this is not just a broad stroke attempt to just get everybody connected or make sure people live in neighborhoods where they can get a smartphone. It's really about how important is the medium, like the old telephone, rotary telephone, for people to be able to engage in activities that are going to ensure that they're healthy, wealthy, and wise.
Fantastic. And when you envision the future, because you're mentioning the future where we're going to be, the internet you'd like to see maybe 10 or 15 years from now, what does that look like? And how would digital access and participation, of course, be different from what we have today?
So that's an interesting question because I do a lot of work through the AI Equity Lab. We'll talk about that a little bit in a lot on artificial intelligence. I think the internet of 10 to 15 years from now means that humans will all be bots, right? We will be an internet without agency, meaning that I think we will automatically wake up and the internet will be like, hi, did you take your medicine today? Good morning, Julia. What is it that you're going to look at? Yesterday, you were online doing X. I do think the internet 10 to 15 years from now will have much more intelligence than we've ever imagined or brokered for or, you know, said that we wanted. And I still think that we'll have challenges of digital access because the internet of today is just not keeping up with the digitally invisible people that exist out in the world, like Joseph, who runs out of minutes on his phone. Could you imagine the compute power that will overlay on top of his costs? Think about subscription services that we're having with advanced technology tools and who will be able to afford that. So I think the future of the internet as a sociologist is that it's going to continue to be unfair, that we're still going to see it as a communications medium. You know, can we talk about it in real, you know, real words, that is still going to be privileged for those that can afford to engage deeply in it and still be lacking for those that get basic access. It's like, You know, whether or not you walk into a room that has standard paint or you're able to bring color to it. I think the internet that we're building is starting with standard paint, but with those who have the privilege to afford the colors, they will do so. And so for me, that's the internet and what it looks like. And I think we're going to still, I hate to say it, have the challenges that we have, you know, today that we had, you know, 30 years ago under President Clinton, that it's not going to be a ubiquitous tool, because as it becomes more monetized and more commercialized, which the internet didn't start that way, it is going to necessarily be a place for the haves and have-nots, which I worry about because there are just things you cannot do. You know, I mean, for those of you listening and you got grandparents or older parents, you're constantly on the phone with them. Mom, did you click this button or that button? I saw you charge this amount of money. Did you mean to do that? Because it's showing up on your credit card statement. Oh, you did mean to do that. I got it. I'm sorry. And I didn't know you like, you know, toe-less slippers, you know, but we're going to have more and more stuff delivered to us. And I think as a result, the internet will be something that's somewhat unwieldy, particularly for those who are slow to adopt or have other challenges to be in safer spaces online where they're not necessarily being exploited for their data, you know, or the activities that they engage. So I'd like to be brighter, but I can't. I'm trying. But we have long surpassed the Jetsons. We are in a new age of dystopia.
Yes. And you've worked with federal advisory commissions and sit on various boards focused on technology policy. What are the most promising pathways you see for actually getting us to a more equitable digital future? Even if it's unlikely, what are the best paths and what needs to happen at the policy level, but also at the community level?
Well, I think it's really important that we have the policy level some framing on what responsible technology looks like. And that's just not in an AI, right? That we have some values around what does it mean to have ubiquitously available and equitable access to the various scopes of technology? And what does that look like, you know, from your private home to the areas in which we saturate public access? And I think having that conversation around, you know, making sure people have access to it, we just experienced, I think, a win with the Supreme Court of the retention of the Universal Service Fund, which has been a lever for many, many decades to help underwrite broadband access for the poor and for schools. So that's not going away anytime soon. So people who still have affordability challenges will be able to take advantage of that fund. But the same token, you know, that fund was fighting for its life, you know, because, again, we somehow think that everybody is connected in some way or form. So, again, I think it's really important for us to ground ourselves with policies that allow for us to expand internet access, given the fact that people have to use it to even access governmental resources. I think that it's also important that people have a certain level of literacy of what they're engaging. And they also have some agency for sort of sharing that with industry, their government, and civil society actors. Like, you know, I'm a day laborer. I have a phone that I can't afford, but I can't work. Because what happens with this technology, which I tried to sort of explain in the book, it's not that the technology fails people, but the technology is a driver within a larger ecosystem that fails people. And so when you're chronically sick and you can't make appointments without going online, or you can't engage in preventative maintenance, or you have to go to a library to check on a breast cancer diagnosis, that goes back into the system and it strains our ability to provide quality access to healthcare. And so for me, I sort of see this as like, we have many promising pathways within certain verticals or sectors, health, employment, education, where we know people need to be connected and they need to be online. But we also have ways in which the internet can be weaponized against communities, you know, for whatever reason, whether the lack of access, you know, sort of thwarting their ability to have an improved quality of life, or too much access engaging in greater surveillance of certain communities. And so, You know, for me, it's sort of like on all the boards I've been on, the National Academies of Sciences, looking at facial recognition use in law enforcement. I've been over the Federal Communications Commission, looking at what makes ubiquitous broadband access. I had a term on the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, looking at highly autonomous AI and how that affects global markets. And my last stint was with the Homeland Security under Secretary Biden, Mayorkas, who was an appointee of President Biden, looking at critical infrastructure and technology. So there's so many ways you could split the onion, right? The key thing is, at some point, the onion has to be baked in the pie, and we need to have a much more coherent policy stance on why we need to make sure that we sort of repair some of these very disaggregated, fractured use cases of technology.
And your work now includes, like you mentioned, the AI Equity Lab, looking at artificial intelligence through the same lens of justice and inclusion. And as AI becomes more central to how we work, learn, and live, and how do we avoid repeating the same mistakes we have made with internet access? And what can we learn from the digital divide to prevent an AI divide?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I think we're almost there, though, right? I mean, we've got conversations that are happening in the artificial intelligence space around compute power, around very expansive applications of, you know, predictive analytics, all the way to large language models as they are integrated into generative AI. We're looking at agentic AI. And what's happening is we're taking for granted that people have digital access, and we're sort of bringing those tools into many of those sectors that I talked about, education, healthcare, employment. And what that means is we're going to create the same divide for people like Joseph or Dr. Trimble in education or Francis at the library, right? Because now they will probably have less agency to the authenticity of their information, and they'll get interpretations back. Now, that's not a bad thing. I've talked to many people in the private sector who are like, oh, I love AI, because generative AI, for example, reads 20 research papers and gives me one great synopsis. But, you know, what we're seeing now is AI sort of creeping into everyday decisions that influence quality of life. And if you're not necessarily a person who's technologically savvy, one, you won't know that AI is making the summary for you. And two, you'll believe everything it says, right? And we know that there are challenges of bias and omission of certain characteristics. So for example, one time somebody asked me on a panel, Julia, well, if AI was used, wouldn't Francis's breast cancer be detected earlier? And I said, no, because unfortunately, Black women are less represented in clinical trials when it comes to breast care and had the highest rates of mortality because of that. So most likely, if AI was used, she probably would die quicker because, you know, they would be less likely for them to pick up on the type of breast cancer she had. Now, it doesn't mean that we're not getting better, and it doesn't mean that AI is not going to help with it. I try to tell people I consider myself to be a both-and person, opportunities and risk. But at the same token, if you don't have basic internet access, you're not going to utilize these tools in ways that can change the quality of your life. And for me, that means that we're going to go through the same life cycle. And it's one that often people don't talk about. I do. I, again, say that people are going to be digitally invisible in AI. And as part of the AI Equity Lab, we just recently launched what I call an unhidden figures repository, with the goal of workshopping things that have consequential impact, healthcare, employment, education. And we've taken myself out of the equation for once, and we've brought in real healthcare practitioners, real journalists, real educators. And we've asked them to sort of help us imagine what a world of AI looks like in their sector. What are the opportunities? What are the risks? And how do we create more unhidden figures in their spaces to be able to speak with Congress or media or in the academy, because they hold the key to the real life solutions. And so I think without that representation at the table, it also furthers the digital divide as it relates to regular everyday people, when experts are not also represented in the decision-making, the model design, as well as execution and interrogation. I mean, we could be here, honey, for another hour talking about this, because this is so near to my heart, because as a sociologist, I just see the same cycle. You know, I see the same in education, just to get on my soapbox for a minute for people who are listening, we say when it's a high resource school district, oh, get rid of the generative AI or only limit it to prompt thinking because it expands the critical inquiry of high resource kids in high resource school districts like my kids. But when a kid across the river, across the train track, you know, uses generative AI, we immediately say they're cheating. Because how could they actually write this way or think this way? And so we've got some values that we have to really address within ourselves to ensure that we're also not looking at these technologies that are leapfrogging and really advancing how we work, how we learn, how we communicate, and we're not doing the same thing by keeping more people behind.
Exactly. It's definitely, it's scary, it's promising, but also scary. I'm a young researcher, I grew up connected, and still I was surprised by some AI generated images. I still have a hard time. In some case, they're very difficult to see that's AI generated and not something real. And I worry about that a lot.
If I could share on that, I mean, I just did an interview for Wired, and it appears that there is some social media AI generated image called Bigfoot Baddies, which are Black women sort of being over sexualized and sort of equated with primates. You know, and I said to the guy, I said, well, first and foremost, we have a history where we have done this to sort of create the type of misinformation around cultural groups. We've seen this in the over exaggeration of cultural attributes, physical attributes when it came to slavery to sort of justify why Black people should be enslaved. We've seen that most recently with migrants who are seen very overemphasized, almost to the point of being made a joke, you know, to sort of justify what's happening with them. And now we see this where I told the guy it's probably being used for entertainment because either someone doesn't know the history or the tools are just so much more sophisticated that just because you can do it, you will. And, you know, part of that challenge is the tech companies, you know, under AI, they really need to show some due diligence and values around how people use those tools. And I think that that's something that is so different from the digital divide. Like the digital divide is all about, do I have a computer? Do I not have a computer? Do I have access to my home? Do I not have access to my home? Am I able to understand what technology is available to me? Can I write my resume online? That's the digital divide community that I've been accustomed to. The AI community is, how fast can I generate content and how fast can I use these tools that sort of teeter on the brink of realness, where it becomes much more harder, more difficult for people to discern whether this is provenance of the image, you know, is real, this comes from something that is like a real person or it's AI generated. And I think for people who are on the wrong side of digital opportunity, it's going to become much more challenging. Is this an AI bot that is really helping me with my Medicaid eligibility? Or is this somebody who's trying to steal my identity? And we're not going to know, right? Because there's not enough policy that's allowing people to have that type of transparency and disclosure. So this is an area that at the Equity Lab, we're like going deeper into when it comes to literacy of AI tools, you know, whether or not you're getting financial counseling from a bot or you're getting it from a real person or a bot that has more liability shields because it's trained by a financial service advisor. But these, I think, are going to be the questions of the 21st century as we see much more emerging technology take over our world.
Yes. And for people listening who want to be part of the solution, whether they're technologists, policymakers, or just concerned community members, what would you tell them? Where can individuals plug into this work in meaningful ways?
Well, I mean, of course, you know, you can watch us and what we're trying to do with the AI Equity Lab. It's really developed for purposeful, pragmatic, you know, on the ground solutions. But I think most importantly, I try to tell people you have to read. You just have to keep reading. Stay engaged, elevate your curiosity. Don't believe everything you read the first time or who it's at the top of your pile is real. But do your own diligence and sort of, you know, do your own diligence to basically find out whether or not what you're reading is legitimate and authentic or something that's AI generated. That's the first thing. The second thing is like, just look at your family, right? And begin to do an assessment of who's connected and who's not. and then overlay that with where they live. And you'll begin to see that much of what we talked about in the podcast when it comes to digital divide is really true. We all have family members that do not have access, or they're not the ones in the conversation on your social media platforms. Or in some cases, they may not be the ones sending you photos of the newborn because they don't have the type of relative access that is needed to be able to do that, whether it's a device or internet connectivity. But start with your own universe to sort of test out these theories that make us believe that everybody is connected and everybody's connected in ways that make sense for them. And then I would say, begin to think about the type of world where we want to balance responsible technology with solutions that engage people in ways that improve the quality of their life. It's okay to go on the internet for entertainment. Don't get me wrong, I do the same thing. But it's also one in which you can get stuck. I mean, like you said, even with you as a researcher, myself, I get stuck. Someone asked me the other day, they said, what's your favorite chat box, Dr. Lee? And I said, none. And they said, why? I said, because I don't want to get caught up in a chat box. I probably be the only, but I will probably be the only living person on the earth that doesn't use a chat box in about, you know, a year or so, because I don't have a favorite. And they said, well, why is it that you don't have a favorite? I said, because there are so many and I'm not quite sure which one is suitable to me and what my needs are, because I don't like a lot of over redundancy of information. And I'm very particular about my writing versus whether or not it's AI generated and being very authentic, you know. And I heard some really cool use cases. Don't get me wrong. The research bots I heard are really excellent and stuff like that. But my point is, like, get to know the technology for yourself so that you can also be in a place of power and agency. And so I would say to anybody who's listening, I'm a sociologist. I'm not a data scientist or computer scientist. I'm a person who understands technology policy after 30 plus years in it, who comes with the intersection of social justice and technology. And so the final thing I would say on that is that you don't have to be a scientist. You have to just be somebody who cares. And if this is an area where you care, you'll dig into it, because it's like my grandmother used to say, a skunk is a skunk. If you see a skunk, if you smell a skunk, there's probably a skunk somewhere nearby. If you are curious about the technology, then find out where that skunk is so you don't get sprayed, is what I would just suggest. Or as my mama would say, only the cooks in the kitchen can be the ones that serve you the food. So if you're not in the kitchen making it, you're most likely on the menu. So find ways to get involved so that you could raise your level of learning and understanding so you can effectuate change.
Thank you. And finally, one last question. Despite all the challenges you document in the book, there's also hope woven throughout these stories. And what gives you optimism about our ability to create a more just digital society?
Yeah, it's so funny. When I was writing the book and I was like all in it, and then the pandemic hit and I had a colleague say to me, nobody likes a bad news ending. I said, yeah, it's like a movie, right? You always want to make sure it ends well. So I said, let me think about what does it take? I mean, I put out some very, you know, strong proposals. This is my policy and me. Unfortunately, many of those proposals have been challenged in the last 6 or 7 months, but I do put out some strong proposals that tie back to my last answer, which is everybody can have agency over this. And we have the tools in our society to embolden people to play a role in the technology ecosystem so that you're not just passive, but you can help teach another person. I propose in the book, like, we need more Peace Corps in the United States when it comes to technology access, teaching people how to use it in productive ways. I stopped writing a book to the point of AI. That'll be my second book. But, you know, for me, it's like, again, understanding the workforce is changing and finding ways to imbue some new ways in which we teach and learn in our K through 20 pipeline that will better prepare young people for the technology that's before them. So making sure people have connectivity to be at the school, outside of the school, but most importantly, making sure that we embed these principles throughout the curricula, I think is really important to me. And then, you know, speaking up against those areas in which technology is weaponized, as I mentioned with the social media content that is very offensive, it's not the only content that's out there. And so finding ways, I like to think of it now, since I wrote the book, that becoming more visible means that more venture capitalists and more innovators sort of enter the space of a world full of five big tech companies and start to think about ways in which they can solve problems. When I came into this space, the first thing that someone, you know, told me about going into technology was it is designed to solve social problems. And if we just return to that mantra that technology is there as an aid to augment and to help us solve, then I think we can find hope at the end of the tunnel. That's why I've kind of changed really over the years. I used to be a Debbie Downer, you know, and very dystopian. And now I tell people, you know, I'm on panels and stuff, or I'm giving keynotes. I think at the end of the day, it's a both and. There are opportunities that come with the technology, and there are certain risks. And our ability to sort of look at spaces in which we're going to be able to solve problems, get people to the moon, understand some of the most complicated diseases by using technology to help us, you know, not only see an image, but analyze it in exponential time. There are always going to be positives like that. And then there'll be areas where, again, people are not represented, the training data is flawed, but that's where the promise comes in. Who are you going to be in this ecosystem? How are you going to make sure that the technology is not weaponized against us? What will be your role and be a more responsible steward and much more literate in the technology that you're engaging? And for me, that's the question, right? Like, people are really clear that they want their agency. And so what I'm suggesting to you, you don't have to be a computer scientist to go in there and see what's in the box of the opaque, but you can be responsible enough to know how you're gonna engage with these tools. And for me, that's the promise that allows people from different backgrounds, different disciplines, different industries to essentially come to the table and have a conversation on what constitutes this new world in which we're living. You know, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of other challenges. We're not gonna talk about that today. I've been on a really good roll. I love talking to people outside of DC. But I think there are promises that can outweigh the perils if we have enough people at the table and we make multiple tables for them to participate.
Wow, what a beautiful way of closing our episode. Thank you so much. This was really rich and I appreciate you joining us today.
I appreciate being here, and people can follow me at the Brookings Institution or on LinkedIn, Nicole Turnerly, Nicole without an E, just remember. And let's keep having the conversation. I really enjoyed being on your podcast. So thank you.
Have a great day.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.